was really turned off by the conduct of the leadership of the Republican Party in Alaska.
Young Republicans allege rule-breaking at the Alaska Caucus. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, March 12th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, Lance Mackey takes stock during a disappointing race for the Iditarod legend.
A little embarrassed. This isn't exactly what I had anticipated again.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Join business, civic, and government leaders from across Alaska and the nation at the 2012 Business of Clean Energy in Alaska Conference, April 19th and 20th at the Dena'ina Center in Anchorage. Clean energy is a $250 billion a year business worldwide, and Alaska has the potential to be a world leader in this growing field. Information at bceaconference.com or 929-7770. This message sponsored by REAP.
Even though Alaska has thousands of miles of shoreline, it's the only state without a coastal management program. It expired last year after the state legislature and the Parnell administration failed to reach a compromise on how much input communities should have over nearby projects on federal lands. But as KUCB's Alexandra Gutierrez reports, supporters of coastal management are working on two separate ways to reinstate the program.
The State House of Representatives has opened consideration of a bill to revive Alaska's coastal management program. On Friday, Lieutenant Governor Mead Treadwell certified a citizens' initiative allowing local input on projects like offshore oil drilling. But sponsors of a bill with a similar objective are hoping to reinstate the program through the legislative process instead. Representative Bob Heron of Bethel is a supporter of the Coastal Management Program and believes that passage of the bill would prevent an expensive fight over the ballot measure. He says the initiative may have popular support in coastal areas, but opponents of the program have more financial resources at their disposal.
The part that I have a problem with is the financial campaign, whether you're for or against it. I would say the people that are against it will carpet bomb the airwaves, and it'll be difficult for people that would support it to have that financial ability to compete.
Proponents of the initiative, like Juneau Mayor Bruce Botello, have also said they prefer going through the legislature because it would get the coastal management program up and running more quickly. When he testified before the House Resources Committee today, he told them not to worry about whether any legislative changes are substantially similar to the initiative.
If it is a good bill and it incorporates, among other elements, the local voice, I suspect that our party would not actively campaign for the initiative.
One of the major differences between the previous program and the initiative is what's called a DEC carve-out. A section changed in 2003 that took the Department of Economic Development out of the process for coastal management activities. Botello says it was added back in as part of the goal of offering a greater consolidation of coastal review. If the carve-out is added back in and the bill passes, the lieutenant governor will have to decide whether that makes the bill so different that the initiative should still be put on the ballot. Not every coastal legislator is offering immediate support for the bill. Last year, Representative Bill Thomas of Haines voted against keeping the program alive, saying that it gave too much weight to local knowledge and that there are other ways for communities to weigh in on nearby projects. He favors letting the initiative onto the ballot.
I'm one of those that believe that, you know, the people want it, let them vote on it. So you put it on the ballot. I think to play the political game in here, it'll happen just like last time. Things will get pulled out and tweaked out and pulled around. Pretty soon you won't have the same bill.
The legislature would need to act on the measure before the end of the session if they want to prevent the initiative from being put on the August ballot. The House Resources Committee held the bill for amendments, and it is not scheduled for another hearing at this time. In Juneau, I'm Alexandra Gutierrez.
Dallas Seavey is hanging on to a narrow Iditarod lead. He pulled into the Elam checkpoint at a little before 4 p.m. this afternoon. Allie Zirkel joined him there soon after. Just a mile or two separated them on the run from Koyuk. Aaron Burmeister, Ramey Smith, and Pete Kaiser are chasing the leaders. By this afternoon, more than half of the 57 remaining mushers had reached Unalakleet, the place where jockeying for position traditionally begins. Among the middle of the pack was former frontrunner and champion Lance Mackey. He looked broken.
A little embarrassed. This isn't exactly what I had anticipated again, but it is what it is, so I'm making the most of it.
He's further back in the race than he was at this point last year when he finished 16th, and he's leaving with 9 dogs, one of whom has a minor injury, but he's too stubborn to drop the dog.
Because it was kind of a self-inflicted wound, keeping this female in heat, and it's caused other issues that are fixable. You know, this particular little issue is he's been working so damn hard trying to get to that female in front of him. He ripped off his toenails. And, well, he's still able to walk with no toenails. It's just kind of painful.
Mackie's lead dog has been in heat since the restart and is driving the rest of his dogs wild. Mackie says he'll finish this race with her, but after she delivers the litter, he might have her spayed. For now.
I really don't have a strategy. I just want to get to know him at this point. Get a real nap and go back to the drawing board.
Mackie isn't the only musher having trouble with dogs in heat. Colorado musher Lachlan Clark scratched back in Galena because too many of his females were in heat, and he was down to a 6-dog team. Thus far, he's finished 5 Iditarods and scratched 3. Looking at the standing board, he says that at this point in the race, the leaders are making key strategic moves.
It's like reading and watching a moving chess game.
For example, Ken Anderson and Mike Williams decided to fly through Shaktulik instead of taking a multiple-hour rest like many of the others. Another frequent strategy is to go straight from Koyuk to White Mountain, though the terrain after Elam could pose some problems if your team isn't up to it.
You got Little McKinley is, you know, it's a not insignificant climb, you know, and if you got pretty tired dogs, they've just done 45 miles and, you know, you got to do a pretty good climb. But once you hit Gollum and you're down, back down on the ice of the lagoon, you can probably get by with a tired dog team, and it's supposed to go straight across the ice of Gullivan.
Brent Sass is the top rookie in this year's race so far. The Fairbanks musher is attempting to complete his first Iditarod after running the Yukon Quest 6 times. He has often found himself surrounded at checkpoints by Iditarod champions like Lance Mackey, Martin Boozer, and Rick Swenson. And he says he's trying to seize every opportunity to learn from them.
Every time that I see one of those guys sitting around, you know, you started to spark conversation with Rick here earlier, and it's awesome. I mean, there's nothing like having a conversation with Rick Swenson, you know, dog conversation. So that's definitely something that I'm really trying to take advantage of, is all the legendary mushers that are involved in the Iditarod, for sure.
At White Mountain, the mushers are required to take an 8-hour break before the final push to safety and then Nome. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, using medieval technology to become more self-sufficient in rural Alaska.
We're going to have to learn to responsibly and reasonably and intelligently harvest and maintain the resources that we have.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Bristol Bay Native Corporation, generations of jobs, heritage, and history. Bristol Bay, a place that's always been. Online at bbnc.net. And by
Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the Trans-Alaska Pipeline with over 700 employees.
Alaska's Super Tuesday events infuse the state's Republican Party with new blood. Young voters registered in large numbers to vote in the 2012 presidential preference poll and to participate in district conventions. But as KSKA's Daisha Eaton reports, many are not feeling a warm welcome from party veterans, and some are even alleging rule-breaking in Super Tuesday's process.
Late last Tuesday night, Randy Riedrich, the chair of the Alaska Republican Party, declared Mitt Romney as the winner in Alaska's presidential preference poll. Riedrich says participation in Tuesday's events was high.
We know we're over 13,705, which is what we had 4 years ago. So we're going to wind up with a larger number of ballots cast.
But not everyone who participated is happy. Evan Cutler is the volunteer organizer for the grassroots group Alaskans for Ron Paul 2012, which has 650 or so members on Facebook. Cutler says Tuesday night his email inbox was overflowing with complaints.
We were receiving reports from a variety of people about different kinds of irregularities, like people complaining that they'd been turned away from the polls, even though they'd registered to vote.
District 18 encompasses all of downtown Anchorage and includes Bootleggers Cove, Government Hill, the South Addition, Fairview, and areas adjacent to Merrill Field. Conventions for six districts, including District 18, were held at the Alaska Shrine. That also happens to be Redrick's voting district.
What I was told happened in that district was that a certain number of people had shown up for Romney and a certain number of people had shown up for Ron Paul, all wanting to be delegates. And the people there realized that they didn't have a definite majority, and in order to keep Ron Paul people from being in the delegate slots, stalled the meeting and took time to call people on the phone and get them to participate remotely.
Rachel Drinkard is the entertainment editor at the Anchorage Press and a young Republican who got fired up by Ron Paul. She was at the District 18 convention and is one of the people alleging rule-breaking there.
I was really turned off by the way that we were treated and the conduct of the leadership of the Republican Party in Alaska.
Drinkard was so turned off that she wrote a letter to the editor at the paper where she works, which appeared last Thursday. Her main complaint, cronyism and old guard Republicans not following their own rules. Drinkard.
There was an attempt at proxy voting, which is strictly forbidden by Robert's Rules of Order, which they claim to follow. Then they had a botched attempt at desperate teleconferencing. Throughout this process, nobody could produce any rules that made what they were doing okay. Just by and large, I kind of got the feeling that we walked into an old boys club and they expected to carry on business as usual and seemed rather surprised when we took issue with it.
David Eastman says each of those things, if true, constitute clear violations of party rules. He's the chair for Region 3 of the Alaska Republican Party, representing Joint Base Elmendorf, Richardson, Eagle River, and the Matsu Valley.
In the 4 years that I've served on the State Central Committee, my experience, unfortunately, has been that the organization really does serve more like a club than an organization. Those that, you know, are on the in that club, treated as such.
Eastman has served as the chairman of his district rules committee and as the chairman of the Matsu Valley Regional Convention Rules Committee. He's a rule expert. His impression of the process?
Unfortunately, some feel entitled that the vote should go their way regardless. And so if it doesn't, then they look for ways of making sure that it does.
State Senator John Coghill from District F, the North Pole area, has been involved with the Republican Party in Alaska for 15 or so years. He says he's challenged Redrick on ethics issues before, and this is not the first time Redrick has been accused of bending the rules to his advantage. According to the Department of Law, Redrick violated the Ethics Act in 2003 by using state resources for partisan political activity while serving in a state agency that regulates oil and gas development. Redrick admitted to some of those charges and paid a $12,000 fine. He also resigned from his position on the Oil and Gas Commission. Coghill says the new allegations are disheartening.
Randy is one that wants to control the meeting, so quite often he'll use the rules to his advantage. And if he misused them and put the Ron Paul people at a disadvantage because of that, then shame on him.
The offices of the Republican National Committee in Washington, D.C. were contacted for this story. RNC officials responded by email saying they hope the issue can be resolved in state and that proxy voting is not authorized during a district convention. Back in Alaska, Ron Paul organizer Evan Cutler says he's setting up an online forum for voters to document their experiences. Despite their concerns, both Cutler and Drinkard say they will be at the state Republican convention next month as alternate delegates, pushing for more transparency and a change in leadership in Alaska's Republican Party. Redrick categorically denies the allegations that he broke any rules and insists the newcomers' complaints are just sour grapes.
In general, I was very pleased. We've probably gotten 5 favorable messages to every unfavorable message that we've received. Some of the unfavorable messages have been helpful in improving the process.
A monthly meeting of the Alaska Republican Party Executive Committee is scheduled for tonight, and Tuesday's process is expected to be discussed. District conventions are continuing throughout the state until March 24th. The state convention is scheduled to take place in Anchorage April 26th through the 28th. In Anchorage, I'm Daisha Eaton.
5 months after its seizure, the stateless fishing vessel Bangoon Perkasa is still tied up at the dock in Unalaska, but not for much longer. Earlier this month, a U.S. District Court judge formally declared the vessel unclaimed. Now the government will seek forfeiture so the Bangoon Perkasa can be sold either for scrap or at auction. KUCB's Stephanie Joyce has more.
When the Coast Guard intercepted the Bangoon Perkasa on the high seas last year, the boat was setting a drift net. Frequently referred to as curtains of death, drift nets are indiscriminate in their harvest and detrimental to ocean ecosystems. They're also illegal on the high seas, so the crew of the Bangoon Perkasa tried to cut their net and flee the Coast Guard. Obviously, they were unsuccessful. The vessel was escorted into Unalaska and the crew deported to their home countries. But no country wanted to claim the Bangoon Perkasa, so the task of locating its owner fell to the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration's Law Enforcement Office. Assistant U.S. Attorney James Barkley is responsible for the case against the vessel. He says it's been a long process.
Not only was the information about this case sent directly to the contact number provided by the master, but in addition, notice of the lawsuit itself and the steps that needed to be taken to join the case and claim the vessel were translated into Chinese, because that's the nationality of the crew, and published several times in the Asian Wall Street Journal, in a seafood trade journal, and even in the Anchorage Daily News.
Perhaps not surprisingly, no one replied. According to court documents, NOAA law enforcement also did some digging into the paper and money trails of the vessel, but that office said they couldn't comment on an ongoing investigation. So finding no owner, the government filed in early March for a default judgment against the vessel, essentially a formal declaration that no one had shown up to challenge the allegation of illegal fishing. A judge signed off on the motion, and as a result, the government can now seek forfeiture of the Bangoon Perkasa. Barkley says it's been a long time coming.
Not all of these cases end up being prosecuted in court, but the Bangoon Perkasa, for example, was spotted doing this type of fishing by the Canadian Air Force more than once in the last 4 or 5 years. And the resources were just not available at the time to get a boat out on the ocean and board the vessel. But we have every reason to think that the Bangoon Perkasa has been fishing illegally like this many more times than just this once when it was caught.
The trick now, Barkley says, is making sure it doesn't end up back on the streets, so to speak.
It's kind of like the maritime equivalent of a beater car, and we want to make sure it doesn't go back to the same line of work. That's why selling it for scrap is one attractive alternative under consideration.
Barkley says the sale is unlikely to generate a lot of money, regardless of whether it's sold for scrap or auctioned off as is.
This was discussed that this is not a multi-million-dollar vessel, and in all likelihood might cost some money by the time it was forfeited. But the decision was made that the gravity of the harm outweighed those expenses. And also the message to the international community that we're not just going to let it go on. Because you see, if people knew that all they had to do was do this type of fishing and do it in a boat that wasn't worth dragging back, then they would know they would be able to get away with it.
NOAA spokesperson Leslie Bales-Sherrod says the total cost of keeping the boat docked in Unalaska since September has been $219,000. The Coast Guard covered the initial cost of de-ratting the ship and getting it port ready, which was estimated at $200,000. Sale of the vessel's catch netted NOAA $33,000, which is currently being held in an escrow account. Bales-Sherrod says the money for the vessel's upkeep will come out of NOAA's asset forfeiture fund and won't affect the agency's operating budget. Barkley says a decree of forfeiture will be filed in the next few weeks, at which point NOAA will be able to move forward with disposal of the vessel. In Unalaska, I'm Stephanie Joyce.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Wells Fargo, providing financial tools and resources for purchasing a home or planning for the future. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A. And by ConocoPhillips. The easy oil is gone, and getting to the remaining oil will be a challenge that will require the state and the industry to work together. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. The State of Alaska Department of Revenue reminds you to file online now for your 2012 PFD and consider sharing a portion of your dividend through Pick, Click, Give or contributing to a college savings plan. More information at pfd.alaska.gov. This message is sponsored by the State of Alaska.
The State Game Board voted down a bear snaring proposal before adjourning from a week-long meeting in Fairbanks on Friday. The state proposal, which would have allowed black bear trapping in areas of the interior to reduce predation of moose, was unanimously rejected by the board. Board Chairman Cliff Judkin says he wants to see the results of ongoing experimental bear snaring programs in two other areas before deciding whether to expand the practice.
I think that what the board's looking at is we've got a couple of programs now that are operated by the department in 16 and down in 19, and I think we're going to probably try to get the results of them in another year before we look at this other stuff.
Judkin says the chance for catching non-target cubs and grizzlies is problematic. He says public safety is also a major concern. The proposal to expand the practice drew major outcry from many Alaskans who say snaring is inhumane, unethical, and not backed up by science. The Alaska Center for the Environment issued an anti-snaring petition signed by more than 3,300 people at the start of the game board meeting in Fairbanks. Students at the Galena Interior Learning Academy are getting a field lesson in a staple of rural Alaska living. Students are set to gather timber from the Yukon River this summer through a new subsistence wood harvesting program with a medieval twist. KIYU's Jeremy Scott has more.
It's called a Z-Wad, and teacher Rand Rosecrans and his students have begun building it. ZWAD is an acronym for Zero Emission Wood Acquisition Device, a takeoff on the ancient Roman ballista catapult weapon.
Another way to look at it is a crossbow on steroids.
The contraption is about the size of a cannon and is comprised of about 20 linear feet of cedar wood. It does not contain a cocking mechanism because of safety concerns. Instead, it's made with a rope that, when manually pulled and released, fires a bolt with an attached grappling hook to reel in wood from anywhere between 150 and 300 feet from the launch point. Rosecrans says he was inspired to take on the ballista in light of ongoing research for a community-wide biomass project, which would aim to use timber to heat city and school district-owned buildings.
We all realize that if we're going to be self-reliant and sustainable and somewhat remain independent out in this part of the country, that we're going to have to learn to responsibly and reasonably and intelligently harvest and maintain the resources that we have.
Right now, Rosecrans and his students are in the final stages of building the prototype. Here, Rosecrans fires up the woodcutter they're using to sculpt the ballista. The students plan to test the ballista prior to May's river breakup. Sophomore Eric Wilhite says experience has taught him just how important that test phase can be.
In my opinion, if you get different torque settings or something malfunctions, I like to keep clear because I've had bad history with rope breaking on me.
Wilhite says he'll err on the side of caution and let someone else be the guinea pig on firing the first shot. Senior Corbett Hine, perhaps.
It's definitely cool. Kind of want to try it at home now.
While Rosecrans is excited about what the project could do for the community, he says his overall thrill comes from the sense of accomplishment he believes it will give his students.
You can see that in their eyes and their faces when they finish one of these things and how excited they are of doing something that they had a big part of. And whether that's, making an omelet or building a ballista, it's true on several different levels. And if we can do that and do more and more of it, I think it helps us to become better teachers, and I think it helps our students to learn more.
Reporting from Galena, I'm Jeremy Scott.
As the leaders in the 2012 Iditarod race travel along the coast, three teams are on their own journey. Dave Munson and his two daughters, 16-year-old Tekla and 11-year-old Shoshana, the family of the late Susan Butcher, are traveling along the last portion of the trail. KNOM's Lorelei Kanin has the story.
Munson says with 2012 marking the 25th anniversary of Susan's first victory in the Iditarod, he and his daughters are mushing from Galena to Nome.
And I think the important thing is for the girls to see what it was that Susan loved and why she loved it, and also to reconnect with the people in the village that had always been so kind to her and learn things about their mother.
Butcher died of leukemia in 2006 and is one of four-time champions. Monson and each of his daughters are driving their own team of sled dogs.
Those two are beating me, so that's just like their mother would have done. No mercy on family members.
Monson says one dog is especially significant. Susan trained the leader until the dog was 2 years old.
Tekla took that dog team, to that particular leader, to Nome 5 years ago, and now my youngest daughter is using it. Her name is Velasa, after the famous voracious dinosaur.
Tekla is going to school on the East Coast and is taking time off to make the trip. Monson says the two girls are very much bonding on the trail.
They talk, and they don't even want me to butt in, so I can see how much this will mean to both of them.
I just think about your girls and to think about them being on this same trail, and that's got to be an incredible thing for you.
You know, it is. I mean, for them to retrace their mother's steps that she did so many times, I think the Portage Trail was one that Susan always loved. She loved going through Old Woman because she felt like she was going home, because Unalakleet had meant so much to her. It was thrilling for her to be able to reconnect with old friends, and for the girls to be able to see that and see how much the villages along the coast embraced her mother and what old friendships are out there, I think is, you know, a wonderful thing for us too.
And heading to the coast, Monson said they will be staying at Old Woman Cabin between Keltag and Unalakleet to watch the lead teams of the Iditarod race by and to stay out of their way. It's believed that there is a spirit that lives in the Old Woman Cabin, and Monson and his girls are acknowledging that belief.
We're going to leave a little tribute out there so the old woman doesn't create mischief for us the rest of the time.
And as for what exactly they'll place at the cabin, Monson isn't quite sure.
Last time I had left some of Susan's ashes up on the top of the Old Woman Hill and made a little cairn up there. And two times ago I left a sign that had her name on it, was pointing the top of the mountain. And I'm going to let the girls decide this year. We'll see. It'll be something special from them.
Dave Monson, the husband of the late Susan Butcher. In Keltag, I'm Lorelei Kinneen.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Dacia Eaton in Anchorage, Alexandra Gutierrez in Juneau, Stephanie Joyce in Unalaska, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Jeremy Scott in Galena, and Lorelei Kinneen in Keltag. APRN's Ann Hillman reported from Unalakleet. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
the Pebble Partnership, developing a comprehensive mine plan that meets Alaska's regulatory requirements while supporting sustainable fisheries in Southwest Alaska. PebblePartnership.com.
Alaska Housing Finance Corporation offers competitive interest rates with programs tailored for first-time home buyers and home choice seminars that cover the details of purchasing and financing a home. There's more information at ahfc.us. This message sponsored by Alaska Housing Finance Corporation. Join business, civic, and government leaders from across Alaska and the nation at the 2012 Business of Clean Energy in Alaska Conference, April 19th and 20th at the Dena'ina Center in Anchorage. Clean energy is a $250 billion a year business worldwide, and Alaska has the potential to be a world leader in this growing field. Information at bceaconference.com or 929-7770. This message sponsored by REAP.
You can find APRN headlines and more online at alaskapublic.org. Local, national, and international news, upcoming events, and statewide community conversation. alaskapublic.org, connecting you to Alaska one story at a time.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.